You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 13th of May, 2013, on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Phil Hahn, and Poppy Trowbridge.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, Bulgarians went to the polls Sunday after forcing the resignation of the previous government. But will these results bring real change, or is it more of the same?
We also head to Tokyo, where our bureau chief Fiona Wilson helps us to set the day's news agenda out of Asia. Fiona, what do you have for us today?
Well, the yen was trading at a new 4.5-year low this morning in Tokyo. Very good news for Japanese exporters. And also, the Japan Coast Guard's been reporting that three Chinese trawlers have been entering Japanese territorial waters.
And a claim we have heard so many times, that humans are not designed for this modern lifestyle, office work and fatty foods. Well, that may not be quite right. Author and evolutionary biologist Marlene Zuk argues that human evolution did not stop during the times of the cavemen. Instead, it's still going strong.
What's really exciting now is that given the tools that we have for looking directly at the genome, it's really clear that genes have changed.
Plus, it's everyone's dirty little secret. Yes, I'm talking about that annual singing contest called Eurovision. We get the views on this year's competition from two experts.
I approach this kind of as a super fan. So for me, it's more about the competition. And even if the songs are bad, I still get really into the contest because I see the passion of the people around me. And it's true that this year the songs don't all float my boat.
All that, plus we'll review this morning's Nordic front pages, and we'll play some great music too, coming up in the next hour here on Midori House.
But before all that, let's catch up with the latest world headlines with Barney Burnham.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. Pakistan's former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif has been holding talks with party colleagues on forming a government after claiming victory in the country's parliamentary elections. The latest unofficial results suggest a big lead for Mr. Sharif's Muslim League, though it's thought he may need support from other parties in order to govern. Former cricketer Imran Khan, who could be the main opposition leader, says he's pleased there was a high turnout, although he's disappointed by reports of vote rigging. Politicians in neighbouring India have been responding to the result. Veteran diplomat and former Foreign Minister Natwar Singh says Mr. Sharif will have a lot on his plate.
Initial weeks and months will be devoted to sorting out his internal problems, including terrorism, how to lift up the economy, how to deal with the situation in Balochistan, how to deal with unemployment, particularly of the educated youth. So they have a multiplicity of problems which have been so far neglected.
Syria has denied being responsible for two car bombs which killed 46 people in a Turkish border town and left more than 50 others being treated in hospital. Information Minister Omran Al-Zubi told a news conference his country did not and never would commit such an act because their values would not allow it. Turkish police say 9 people have been arrested in connection with Saturday's attacks in Reyhanlı. Ankara says it suspects the involvement of Syrian intelligence. Exit polls show the rightist GAB party has held the lead in Bulgaria's elections. The polls have been marred by suspicions of rigging, but GAB may be able to control a slim majority in parliament with the help of the nationalists. The party, whose government resigned after violent demonstrations against poverty and corruption in February, is expected to win 31% of the votes ahead of the socialists on 27%. Police in New Jersey have killed a gunman who'd been holding 3 children in a bedroom with the body of their dead mother and another child. A SWAT team burst into the house in Trenton shortly before 4 a.m. on Sunday. They used stun grenades and fired a single shot at Gerald Murphy. He died shortly after the siege ended. Colonel Joseph R. Fuentes of New Jersey State Police.
For days, the lives of 3 children were placed at great risk by the presence of one individual who was their captor, Gerald Tyrone Murphy, age 38. Today, those children have been rescued from a deadly threat and horrible circumstances at the hands of an armed subject.
At least 19 people have been injured in a shooting at a Mother's Day parade in New Orleans. Police say 2 people needed surgery after the shooting, and the injured included 2 young children. The shooting started as the parade passed through the city's French Quarter. The reasons for the shootings are unclear, and two or three suspects were seen fleeing the scene. Police Superintendent Ronald Serpas.
These are unusual circumstances. We have second lines that occur in the city of New Orleans virtually every weekend at this time of the year. We had a full complement of police officers. It appears that these two or three people, just for a reason unknown to us, started shooting at, towards, or in the crowd. It was over in just a couple seconds. Police were everywhere, and we hope that anybody who saw anything will give Crime Stoppers a call.
The British Prime Minister David Cameron has arrived in the United States for his first visit to the country since President Obama's re-election. His three-day visit will begin at the White House and finish in New York, where he's expected to take part in UN talks on agreeing new global development goals. He'll receive a detailed briefing from the FBI on the Boston bombings to see if Britain can learn lessons from the American response. He's also expected to express his condolences to the victims of the attack. Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Thanks, Barney. It is 6 minutes past the hour, so if you're in Tokyo, it's 16:06, 8:06 if you're with us here in London, and 23:06 in Anchorage. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
And welcome back. You are indeed listening to Midori House live from Studio One here in London. It's time now to get ready and set the day's news agenda with the three big stories you'll need to know for the next 24 hours.
And joining us to set today's agenda is Fiona Wilson, our Tokyo Bureau Chief. Fiona, welcome to the show. What have you got for us this morning?
Hello there. Well, sort of headline news here at the moment is what's happening to the yen. Everyone's watching this very closely, particularly after the G7 meeting this weekend. And the yen, after that meeting, the yen has hit a new low, which is actually good news for exporters. It was trading about 102 yen to the dollar. It hasn't been that low for 4.5 years. So that's very big news here.
What's the reaction been, though, from some of Japan's neighbors? Obviously, Japan's low yen is great news for their exporters, but it's not necessarily great news for their companies. Many people have even floated around the idea of currency manipulation. Is that something that's starting to gain a bit of traction?
Well, I think the interesting thing about the meeting at the weekend, the G7, everyone says it didn't come up. Japan was not accused of currency manipulation. And I think the relief that happened, that it didn't become an issue, is partly why the yen has dropped even further. I mean, I think the big complaints will probably be coming from America, in fact, that the car industry in the States will not be happy to see these figures, because obviously it's very good news for Toyota, for example, whose exports are looking very, very healthy, and they're expecting to post some very serious profits quite soon, and record sales of cars. So I think the problem will, rather than Japan's neighbours, I think it would be more like the US car industry complaining a bit. But there's actually, it seems that it wasn't raised, the issue of manipulation.
Fiona, there was a sort of delicate balance in the language, though, coming out of the G7, where they said that they were happy with the way Japan was trying to get back on the growth track. At the same time, as a group, they reinforced their commitment to not manipulating currencies, because here in Europe, that's also been a consideration to try and get growth growing again. I mean, do you think there was anything that we should be reading between the lines of that statement?
I think it's just that, you know, Japan should be aware that everyone else is watching what's going on. So
got a close nobody eye wants on them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I mean, Japan will not be unaware of that. It sticks very firmly to the line that what it's doing with the economy is all about domestic issues. It's about deflation. It's not about currency intervention.
Right.
And it's sticking very firmly to that. Yeah.
Focusing on the economy, trying to boost prices and wages, but it's not specifically an export strategy. That's their argument.
That's their argument, and they're sticking to it.
Of course, this is all part of Shinzo Abe's Abenomics plan, which everyone has been discussing. Is there a sense on the streets then of Tokyo, for example, that there's a bit more enthusiasm at the future of Japan? A lot of people enthusiastic that, hey, we're actually getting back on track. Things are going to go okay.
Yeah, I think that is a definite feeling. I mean, his ratings are remarkably good. I think people were almost quite... You know, they're quite pessimistic when he won a very serious landslide election in December. But generally, the feeling was that it would pretty quickly, you know, he'd come to earth pretty quickly. And actually, his ratings have been very good. They're hovering about 70% at the moment, which is really good for a Japanese government. As you know, it's a bit of an in and out policy with the Japanese prime ministers. You barely get to know their names and they've disappeared. So I think he's actually considered to be doing very well and certainly better than most people were expecting. He hasn't created the problems with China that a lot of people were expecting. That was one of the big issues before. And he's come out very aggressively on the economy, which is I think what really concerned people in Japan, not what's going on with China. It's actually all about the economy.
And you know, Fiona, how everyone's worried in the UK that it will follow that Japanese example. Perhaps now we've got a more positive example to follow. It's interesting to see how that will develop. Speaking of China, take us on to your next story. Three Chinese ships entering Japanese waters. Explain a little bit about what happened here.
Well, I just saw an update on that story, actually, because I was quite interested earlier in the day. It happened this morning, Japan time. The Japanese Coast Guard reported that three ships had entered Japanese territorial waters. That's been happening quite a lot, actually, since September, since last autumn. That's been happening a lot. And the update now is that they were maritime surveillance ships, Chinese surveillance ships. So it's just a reminder of this sort of psychological warfare that's really going on between Japan and China. It's a sort of game of intimidation. These Chinese ships pop into Japanese waters, the Japanese Coast Guard asks them to leave, they don't respond, and then they do leave. And that's really been a bit of a pattern. It doesn't amount to anything. There's been, you know, it's not like it's a, there's going to be any confrontation, but it's just a sort of low-grade battle of attrition, I would say.
And it now looks like over the weekend, China is taking its stab in this game as well. In an article in the People's Daily newspaper, China questioned Japan's sovereignty over the islands of Okinawa.
I know. I mean, as if things aren't bad enough in terms of Japan-China relations. You know, and the People's Daily is obviously sanctioned by the Communist Party. So it's quite serious when a scholarly report like that comes out, which says, well, now we're looking at the ownership of Okinawa, which is Japan's southernmost prefecture. The Japanese have come out very firmly and said there's just no discussion about Okinawa. I mean, there's barely a discussion about the Senkaku between these two countries, but you know, Japan does not want Okinawa brought onto the table at all. And actually, it was also mentioned in a Hong Kong, a Chinese language Hong Kong paper as well this weekend, a similar discussion. And I, you know, it's a game of it's a sort of intimidation strategy. It's just a case of, you know, bringing up these rather awkward subjects and what do they amount to? You know, it adds the pressure on. I think really the Senkaku is the flashpoint. I don't think people really think that Okinawa is going to become the next flashpoint, but, you know, it does add up to something.
But Fiona, you say when these Chinese ships enter Japanese waters, the Japanese don't react. Yet when China makes claims about Okinawa, they do. I mean, if you combine these two, will we see a reaction from Japan perhaps the next time Chinese ships do enter the waters? Is this whole thing snowballing, or is this, like you said, sort of a back and forth that's likely to continue that way?
Well, I mean, I think diplomatic reaction is very different from, you know, reaction on the ground. The Japanese Coast Guard is obviously not looking to have a physical confrontation. That would be absolutely disastrous for everyone involved. I think that the best way for both countries to move forward is diplomatically. And, you know, it's quite natural that Japan would have a reaction to an article like the one that appeared in the People's Daily. It has to react. It can't just let something like that go by, particularly at the moment. But I don't think Japan and China are on the brink of war. At the moment, it's a war of words, I would say.
Well, this war of words definitely part of Shinzo Abe's more hawkish, nationalistic policy since taking office. But it looks like he may be getting himself into a bit of trouble when it comes to some of his partners in his coalition.
Well, it's an interesting one. You know, I think you hear so much about the coalition in the UK and the troublesome junior partner. And it's interesting. It hasn't really come up here, but we have elections here probably in July. It's not confirmed yet, but the upper house elections and the ruling party, the Liberal Democratic Party, that's Shinzo Abe, the Prime Minister's party, they're looking to take a majority. And their junior coalition party, the new Kometo party, Their sort of strategy for the upper house election has just been revealed, and it really contradicts quite a lot of Shinzo Abe's key policies. So it'd be interesting to see what happens there. I mean, they are not supporting changes to the constitution. They don't want to restart reactors. They want to make sure there's public support for nuclear reactors being restarted. They're going in heavily on social policy, saying they want to absolutely get rid of nursery waiting lists. And It's a very different kind of agenda, and it seems they're trying to differentiate themselves at a time when it's really so dominant, the LDP. It's very difficult for the small New Comeito party to stand out.
Fiona, thanks so much. I think we have to leave it there. That was Fiona Wilson. That's Monocle's Tokyo Bureau Chief, helping us set the agenda today. Thank you for this.
Coming up, we'll find out if it's time for us to eat and live our lives like the cavemen did.
Culture on Monocle 24 is untouchable. Go on, just try and do it. Try and grab a handful of the top-grade cultural radio that we're dishing out and see if you can touch it. Well, exactly. Luckily, though, you can feel it. Feel the passion of the unusually button-bright presentation.
It's a fantastic contrast, and it's one of those ones that ask you to look at the brushwork, to look just at the canvas.
Feel the craftsmanship in the breathtaking live Midori House sessions.
You know, I consider myself an entertainer, so I'm really about communication. I'm not really about expressing myself so much as trying to communicate with people and bring them to tears or bring them to laughter or what have you.
Feel the lovingly hand-stitched production, and most of all, feel the love of art.
It's there, and it's true, but it's really only a small part of his work.
Feel the love of fiction, feel the love of film, feel the love of music, feel the love, generally.
It is the most extraordinary collation of works that you would never normally see together.
Why not invite me round? Culture with Robert Bound is a well-behaved house guest and a joy to entertain.
That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
All around the world, Monocle 24's growing network of correspondents bring you the latest news, reportage and insight from Beirut to Bogota, Sydney to Singapore.
For Monocle in Paris, I'm Tom Burgess-Watson.
For Monocle in Berlin, I'm Kimberly Bradley.
For Monocle in Pristina.
In New York.
In Cairo.
In Sao Paulo.
I'm Guy Delaunay.
From Monocle.
From Monocle.
In Tel Aviv.
From Monocle.
In San Francisco.
In North Vancouver.
In Ramallah.
I'm Aisha Spears.
I'm Joseph Dane.
From Monocle, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
From Monocle. In Hong Kong, I'm Liv Levitchner.
In London.
Bangkok.
Buenos Aires.
In Bogota.
So whether you want to know what's happening in the corridors of power, in the boardrooms of the aviation giants, or the ateliers of the best design companies, stay tuned to Monocle 24. Monocle 24. Keep you an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back to Midori House. The time here in London is 17 minutes past 8 o'clock in the morning. Now, how many times have you heard the argument that humans are not designed for this modern lifestyle? Office work, television, and calorie-rich food. Well, instead, we should try to live as our predecessors did tens of thousands of years ago. As trendy paleo diets and paleo philosophy go, we should move as much as we can, try to eat what was eaten 40,000 years ago, and stay away from computers or any modern technology. That sounds a bit too difficult for me.
Can you imagine that?
No, I cannot.
Some withdrawal I couldn't bear. Well, it's not quite true, argues Marlene Zook. She is an evolutionary biologist and author of the new book, Paleo Fantasy: What Evolution Really Tells Us About Sex, Diet, and How We Live. She claims that human evolution did not stop tens of thousands of years ago. Instead, it has continued, and therefore humans today are very different from the times when we all still lived in caves. While this undermines claims that we should try to eat as the cavemen did, or that the Western lifestyle is indeed damaging to our well-being. Well, earlier, Monocle's producer-presenter Marcus Hippe spoke with Marlene Zook herself.
One of the key terms in your book is paleo fantasy. How would you explain this term?
It's a word that I borrowed from an anthropologist, Leslie Aiello, who was originally using it to talk about the stories that we create to inform ourselves about the way humans used to be like. She used it in a meeting where there were scientists discussing early human brain evolution, and she was asking, well, is this really science, or are we just coming up with paleo fantasies? And I thought that's a perfect term for the way all of us tell ourselves stories about what our evolutionary history was like. And we do that about what we were like in terms of our diet, in terms of our family life, in terms of our sex life. And then we try to make sense of our current situation by referring back to that. And I wanted to explore that idea a little bit because I'm very interested in the way that evolution happens.
Where do you base your claim that evolution has still continued during the last, say, 40, 50,000 years?
I don't think it's a controversial claim at all. It's something that's obvious from looking at the evidence that if you take, as its basic definition, a change in gene frequencies in populations over time, then evolution's happening to all organisms all the time, and you know, humans shouldn't, there's no reason to expect that humans would be any exception. What's really exciting now is that given the tools that we have for looking directly at the genome, so we can use genomic tools to understand changes at a very fine scale among populations of humans or in other living things, it's really clear that genes have changed. Now, that doesn't mean that all genes have changed or that all organisms are completely different from their ancestors. I mean, it's obvious we're not completely different from our ancestors. But at the same time, what these tools are showing us is that we're both different from the way we were 40 or 50 or even 10,000 years ago. But we've also been carrying around and continue to carry around genes that we share with our very, very distant ancestors. So it's not really accurate to say, oh, you know, humans have genes that were, you know, a product of the Stone Age or a product of the Pleistocene or however you want to call it. We have this amalgam of genes, and some of them we share with bacteria, and some of them we share with fish, and some of them we only share with other humans.
Quite often we idolize those times when we still were cavemen hiding in bushes. Are you saying that we shouldn't really use all the information we have of those cavemen as reference points? For example, when we think of what they used to eat, eating berries, fasting every now and then, and doing a lot of exercise.
So in very broad scale, of course it makes sense to say, you know, what are our bodies and brains like? What's going to be the best for our health? I mean, there's no reason to start from first principles and say, oh, gee, you know, we've got this human in front of us. You know, what would it be best off eating? You know, should we be eating paper? Should we be eating light bulbs? Should we be eating, you know, oh, I know, maybe we should be eating, you know, fruits and nuts. And you know, so it's ridiculous to suggest that we can't use the way our physiology works, which is a product of evolution, as a way to think about our diets. But at the same time, I think the word you used is perfect, that, you know, that we need to be careful about idealizing a particular point in history as saying that that's the one where we ended up at this pinnacle of perfection, and if we deviate from that, we're going to run into trouble, because that's not necessarily true. I think that's a misreading of the way evolution actually happens.
Could you give me some very recent examples of how human evolution has still continued?
I'll give you two. One is an example that, because it's so well known, it's not quite as recent as some, but it's such a beautiful example of the way we now understand how evolution has continued to work, and that's the evolution of lactase persistence, the ability to digest dairy products. So, of course, we know that most mammals, including a lot of humans, can't digest dairy or, you know, milk after weaning. And that's a very, you know, common pattern. It's because we lose an enzyme, lactase, that allows us to break down the sugar in milk. But only about 5,000 to 7,000 years ago, which is just the blink of an eye from the standpoint of evolution, what happened was that people were herding cattle, which they were doing for meat and hides, not for dairy products. But people who just happened to have a variation on that gene that allowed them to continue to digest dairy had an advantage over people that couldn't. They had an extra source of nutrition. They might have had a source of uncontaminated fluid in places where, you know, unpolluted water was at a premium. And so they were able to survive and reproduce and pass on their genes better than other people that couldn't digest dairy.
Since the evolution still continues, how much more do we need to wait until we all are perfectly accustomed to the Western lifestyle so that we can eat a lot of greasy food and spend our days in the office watching a laptop screen?
A way to look at that is that, remember, it's not that we're ever going to be perfectly adapted to this lifestyle, because we weren't perfectly adapted to the other one either. That all the time, evolution results in this, you know, kind of set of compromises and trade-offs and things that, well, they work okay in this situation, but then they don't work so okay in another situation. In the book, I talk about it being kind of like, you know, it's a broken zipper. So, it'll hold your trousers on, but, you know, there's bits that are kind of gapping and things that are not really working okay. And 'twas ever thus, because evolution isn't ending up with things being perfect. It's ending up with things that are good enough.
Well, I don't know if I could survive on a diet of berries or paper.
No, it wouldn't do it for me, but a diet that includes a whole lot of wild boar, I could manage.
And that was, of course, author and biologist Marlene Zook there, talking to Monocle's Marcus Hippie about her new book, Paleo Fantasy: What Evolution Really Tells Us About Sex, Diet, and How We Live.
Now, Bulgarians voting in parliamentary elections yesterday will be waking up to exit polls showing a tight finish today between the centre-right GERB party and its socialist rivals. Now, while GERB is showing a slight advantage, it could fall well short of a majority in the 240-seat parliament when the full results come in. But for now, partial results are showing that Boyko Borisov's GERB party has about 31% of that vote.
And they are now scrambling to secure an alliance that will allow them to govern, but with an image marred by protests and allegations of illegal activity, they may struggle to find partners. Well, what does this mean for the political stability of the European Union's poorest member state? Well, we put that question to Andrew McDowell, correspondent and analyst covering Southeastern Europe for publications including the Financial Times. Andrew joins us now on the line. Thanks very much for coming on the show, Andrew. Well, we seem to be back at square one, aren't we?
Well, there's certainly going to be a period of horse trading after this election. No one is a clear winner. No one's got over that crucial 120-seat barrier to get an absolute majority. And as you say, it's the EU's poorest country. There are a lot of economic issues. This is a country that is badly in need of good government. And it remains to be seen who will form that government from now. I think Gerd possibly at this stage too tainted by the past few years and particularly the scandals of recent weeks, including wiretapping, to actually form a government. And maybe the opposition parties will be able to creep over the line.
Andrew, people were coming out onto the streets yesterday with this sort of non-result. What do you think will be the atmosphere there on the street? What do you think will happen today?
Well, one of the first reactions that you have from many Bulgarians and from analysts is that the four parties who have got into parliament all are part of the old Bulgarian political elite, with the possible exception of ATAKA, which is an ultra-nationalist force. So we've got a lot of the same old faces here. And I think even the opposition doesn't necessarily represent the hope that was expressed by people going onto the street to topple the last government. We've got the Socialist Party, who still linked in many Bulgarians' minds to the communist past and to their spells in power since then. So there's a lack of real change, I think. So I think that the people who are protesting and the many Bulgarians at home who support them will possibly still be disappointed and not see the concrete change that they were hoping for. Though, of course, it remains to be seen which government is formed and what reforms they can put in place.
And I think that really is probably the key point, especially for people outside of Bulgaria looking in. They'll wonder to themselves, it was only in February when people protested on the streets and were demanding the resignation of the government. That happened. And now it seems like they've re-elected that same government that they were hoping to get rid of.
Well, I mean, it should be emphasised that GERB, who were in parliament and who were toppled, the government party, they did only get, as you said, 31% of the vote or so. So you have a large number of people who, I would imagine, actively voted against them. Perhaps the biggest problem in Bulgarian politics is that a lot of people neither want GERB, who were toppled by the street protests, nor the socialists, who are still 23 years after the fall of communism, seen as being tainted by that communist past, the BSP, the Socialist Party. And you had 25% of the electorate yesterday voting for parties who didn't cross the 4% threshold to get into parliament. So there's a lot of popular upset against the incumbents, GERB and the socialists. And yet there's no coherent opposition. There's no coherent alternative.
So what looks like set to happen then? The socialists have said they won't negotiate with the GERB party. It doesn't look like the nationalists will negotiate with the GERB party either. So will this call for new elections sooner rather than later?
I would have thought that's a distinct possibility. In talking to analysts last night, this seems to be an option. Looking at the arithmetic with the votes counted, about 60% so far, it's possible that the socialists could go into a coalition with the DPS, which is a party largely backed by Turks and Muslims in Bulgaria. It's regarded with suspicion by many Bulgarians, but had a very loyal vote base. They possibly could form a minority administration. They've worked together in the past. Neither of them will be keen to go into a coalition with the nationalists, who obviously are seen as political poison in an EU country. So that's a possibility. But I think fresh elections, in which it's possible that the opposition forces who are protesting on the streets could coalesce into something approximating a political force, are a possibility.
Andrew McDowell there, thanks very much for joining us on the line. Correspondent and analyst covering Southeastern Europe for publications, including the Financial Times. Now, in the next half hour of the program, we get the latest on what is new and exciting in Toronto's music scene.
If you dig a little deeper, you're going to find records that are amazing and not as poppy or mainstream, but just great music.
We also start this week's Eurovision series and browse through the Nordic papers. But first, here's Barney Burnham with the latest news headlines.
Thanks, Poppy. Pakistan's former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif has been holding talks with party colleagues on forming a government after claiming victory in the country's parliamentary elections. The latest unofficial results suggest a big lead for Mr. Sharif's Muslim League, though it's thought he may need support from other parties in order to govern. Syria has denied being responsible for two car bombs which killed 46 people in a Turkish border town and left more than 50 others needing treatment in hospital. Information Minister Omran Al-Zubi says his country did not and never would commit such an act because their values would not allow it. Exit polls show the rightist GAB party has held the lead in Bulgaria's elections. The polls have been marred by suspicions of rigging, but GAB may be able to control a slim majority in parliament with the help of the nationalists. Police in New Jersey have killed a gunman who'd been holding three children in a bedroom with the bodies of their dead mother and another child. A SWAT team burst into the house in Trenton shortly before 4 a.m. on Sunday. They used stun grenades and fired a single shot at Gerald Murphy. At least 19 people have been injured in a shooting at a Mother's Day parade in New Orleans. Police say two people needed surgery after the shooting and the injured included two young children. The British Prime Minister David Cameron has arrived in the United States for his first visit to the country since President Obama's re-election. His three-day visit will begin at the White House and finish in New York, where he's expected to take part in UN talks on agreeing new global development goals. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thanks, Barney. You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Poppy Trowbridge, and Phil Hahn.
On this week's preview of The Culture Show with Robert Bound, we find out what's new and exciting in Toronto's music scene. Beatmakers Jill Masuda and Nick Timar have been creating hip-hop themed tracks for artists from their home city as the production duo Circle Research for over a decade.
Now, they're stepping out from behind the mixing decks to sing on their own tracks as the pop project The Precious Lows. Masuda stopped by Midori House for our Culture Show to talk about the Toronto music scene and share some of its music with Monocle's Tom Hall. Here's a little preview of their conversation.
Toronto is mostly known for its indie rock exports, Broken Social Scene, Feist, Peaches, but a lot of people don't know that there's a really great burgeoning scene right now coming out of Toronto, which is sort of more on an electro soul tip and an instrumental beat tip. So yeah, I just came here today to maybe play a few tracks and talk about that. It's a really exciting time right now in Toronto, and it's great to be a part of it.
So with no further ado, I mean, what's the first tune that we're going to be hearing today?
So the first tune I picked is from an artist called Maylee Todd, a great singer, songwriter, multi-instrumentalist, and a good friend of mine, actually. She has a new album out. It's called Escapeology on Do Right Music. So this is my favorite song off the album, and it's called I Can't Stand It.
Selfish heart by the stand it, you know I won't stand it. What you gonna do when they break your back? I can't stand it, you know I won't stand it.
So that was Maylee Todd with I Can't Stand It. And I mean, I did a little bit of research myself. That's quite I don't have to research how it sounds. That's quite a smooth kind of
smooth.
It's got a kind of almost a disco feel to it. I heard a couple of her other tracks which are quite disco influenced.
While she was writing this album, she was listening to a lot of 80s electro, boogie disco artists like Evelyn Champagne King and Tana Gardner, things like that. So it was very much influenced, as you can hear in the sound, by what she was listening to at the time. And even we had been introducing her to new artists and stuff that she hadn't heard before. And yeah, she really just kind of grabbed a hold of that sound and made it her own.
And what are your thoughts on sort of translating disco to a new audience? Because everyone loves disco, everyone does love it. But because so much of it is actually very smooth and serene, mm-hmm. there's always like the chance that it can almost become a little bit innocuous, you know, like a sort of lift music sound. You know, I should definitely point out that Maylee's music is not falling into that trap. And that's kind of the art, I think, of sometimes producing those records, like producing something really smooth, but that, you know, is going to take someone somewhere, as opposed to not feel, leave them feeling kind of just left behind, if you know what I mean.
Absolutely. I mean, well, you say that everyone loves disco, but actually for a long time there was a stigma attached to disco, the whole disco sucks thing. But that was when disco became too mainstream. But if you dig a little deeper, you're going to find records that are just amazing and not as poppy or mainstream, but just great music.
So, okay, that's Maylee Todd. Should we move on to the next tune? Who have we got next?
So the next artist is Bird, full name Zarin Bird, also a good friend of mine from Toronto. And he has a new album coming out in July, called La Note. He had a music video on Vimeo for a few years now, I think, and it's got up to 159,000 views, and it became a Vimeo staff pick. So he's also just a brilliant director and cinematographer. He did it all himself. So the song that I want to play is called The Whole World Knows. It's also featured on a great compilation called Around Sounds, which features a lot of Canadian artists that are sort of on the cusp of doing good things. So yeah, this is called The Whole World Knows. I said, oh,
that was Bird with The Whole World Knows. That was an extremely chilled out bit of music, wasn't it?
Yeah, I love chilled out music personally. So that song is one of my favorite songs off that compilation.
Yeah, like, and we were just discussing while it was playing there that a little bit of a touch of the Toro et moi kind of
definitely
sound.
Definitely, yeah.
And is there a lot of that around Toronto? As you say, I mean, there's this, people know the Buck 65s and the Feists and the Peaches and stuff like that. I mean, is there a lot of that kind of quite club kind of sound bubbling under?
Absolutely, to an extent, because nowadays with the internet and blogs, you can basically get exposed to something at the touch of a button. But in terms of getting play in the clubs, like, you won't hear Toro et moi or any kind of chill wave stuff in the clubs at this point. But there's definitely a group of people that are checking for that kind of music.
And we can't talk about Toronto without talking about the music that you make yourself.
I mean, absolutely.
Do you want to give people a little primer on, because, I mean, you've been doing this a long time. Like, how did you start out and where are you right now?
Okay, well, we started out with Circle Research, me and my partner Nick Timar. And we've been partners for 20 years now, and we've been releasing music since 1996. So through Circle Research, we had a radio show on Ryerson University. We did that for 10 years, and so we got a bit of a name in the Toronto hip-hop community.
So, and your latest project is The Precious Lows.
So The Precious Lows is our new project. We've been working on this for 3 years, and we decided to change the name because Circle Research is more known as being DJs and producers, and we've produced for other artists and done remixes for a bunch of local artists, Ivana Santilli, Elizabeth Shepherd. We've worked with Apostle of Hustle, who are on Arts and Crafts, did a remix for them. So we thought, now that we are doing most of the vocals on top of our beats and doing the songwriting, we should probably change the name because it's a new sound. It's a whole new thing. We wanted to separate this new project from what we've done in the past, because this is probably the most personal project that we've had to date. because now not only we're making the music, but we're writing the words and doing the singing. So we changed the name to The Precious Lows, which is kind of a double meaning. You know, it's the low end in the music, the bass, it's so important to make you feel the grooves. But at the same time, there's the precious lows in life. You have your highs and your lows, and you need those lows in order to appreciate the highs.
Yeah. Okay, well, I mean, I think we should check some of that out. I mean, what tune are we going to hear last?
So we're going to hear a brand new song. Actually, my mastering engineer just emailed this to me 2 days ago.
This is an M24 exclusive.
It's a world premiere. I've only heard it like once or twice on my iPod. So make sure you blast it nice and loud, okay, Alex? this song is called More Than Friends, and it features Maylie Todd.
So now I've just got to know.
And that was Jill Masuda speaking to Monocle's Tom Hall for this week's edition of Culture, which you can, of course, catch at 1900 hours London time or 1400s if you are in New York City.
You're listening to Midori House, and we'll be right back after this with the first installment in our series on that very guilty pleasure, Eurovision.
Each week on The Curator, one of our Monocle editors rounds up the very best of the week just gone on Monocle 24.
I went to Afghanistan under the Taliban when I was 26 years old, and I sort of just saved my money and went to photograph women living under the Taliban, and now I realize, wow, that was pretty dangerous.
From hard-hitting political interviews to live music sessions, from food and film to retail and travel, we'll handpick the best of the week shows for an hour of essential listening.
A fair at the end is on the one side a market platform, but I think especially here in Asia and in Southeast Asia, it should also be a place of an exchange, of a get-together.
That's The Curator, premiering every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time on Monocle 24, brought to you in association with Rolex.
You're listening to Midori House. The time is 16:41 if you're in Tokyo. That means it's 8:41 a.m. here in London. Now, Europe's broadcasters and most competitive pop acts will descend upon Malmo next week as we approach the final of this year's Eurovision Song Contest. And not one to miss out on a party, Monocle 24 will be there as well, courtesy of Eurovision fanatic Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
All this week on Midori House, you'll be able to enjoy Fernando's guides to the semifinals and the finals, interviews with musicians, and there will also be a special final live update on next Saturday's review. Well, for today's Midori House, Fernando caught up with another journalist and Eurovision obsessive, William Lee Adams, who's already in Malmo, Sweden, to find out, as if he needed convincing, why Eurovision matters.
Before we talk about this year's event, William, what is the importance of Eurovision for Europe?
I think we have to look at it historically. Eurovision was set up in the wake of World War I and World War II, when Europe had been torn apart by carnage, and it was all about bringing people together and letting them compete through song rather than with guns and weapons. Today it's slightly different. Perhaps intercontinental kind of warfare is less likely, but it's all about understanding these new countries that have come in from the East, allowing them to integrate with the West, and giving them and smaller countries in Western Europe a chance to compete on a level playing field. You're not going to see Malta winning many medals at the Olympics, but at Eurovision, you can see them giving it a good go.
So is there some sort of political importance to it, or is it just kind of is just an extravagant event of great costumes?
I think it really varies by country. If you look at countries like the Ukraine, Azerbaijan, they take this incredibly seriously, and they really see it as a way of them showing the rest of Europe that they too are valid members of the European community. But if you look in countries like Sweden, it's more of a business proposition. The state broadcaster stages an elaborate national selection contest to choose their candidate for Eurovision. The albums that the contestants in their national contest produce every year goes platinum. It's the number one rated show on television. I believe 80% of people who own TVs watch the final. So in Sweden, it's much more about putting on a great show and having good entertainment.
William, can you spot any trends throughout the years in terms of the winning songs?
I think that upbeat songs with an ethno-folkish background tend to do very well. If you look at 2010, when Alexander Rybak from Norway won, he actually played a fiddle. He's of Belarusian descent, and so he kind of brought traditional music into the frame. But then in 2012, we had an electro-pop song win by Loreen from Sweden, which kind of I guess, upset that trend. It was the first time in a long time that such a modern electronic song had won. And you see this year, more people are bringing electronic songs to the table as a result of that. Norway, which is one of the strong contenders, has a very modern electronica sound, and she's one of the favorites.
And she's on our playlist as well, Margaret Berger, a great song. And William, well, just I want to test you now. What is your favorite winning song ever on Eurovision?
You know, my favorites never win, which is kind of upsetting.
Same
one
years.
Of my favorite songs of all time finished second at the 2007 contest. That was Verka Sergichka from the Ukraine with Dancing Lasha Tumbai. Unbelievable staging. I really loved the freedom, the cross-dressing. It was quite transgressive in a way. And the song was actually banned in Russia, and so was Verka Sergichka, because at one point he says something about looking west and goodbye Russia. And at that time, the Ukrainian government was debating its position and relations with Russia.
What about the great Dana International?
Oh, just a fantastic song, because I really think she's spoke to the pain of transgender people across the world. And back, I believe that was a 1998 contest, it was even more stigmatized than it is today, but she had the strength and courage to stand up and sing. And very interesting, in Israel that year, right-wing politicians and other conservative members of the public suggested that Dana was an embarrassment, that they should remove her from the stage because Israel could not be seen in that light. But Europe really embraced her and took her straight to the top.
Are you excited by this year's event, William? Have you looked at all the contestants, or do you think this is not a vintage year?
It's interesting because I approach this kind of as a super fan. So for me, it's more about the competition. And even if the songs are bad, I still get really into the contest because I see the passion of the people around me. And it's true that this year the songs don't all float my boat. There's some real train wrecks out there. But in a way, it makes it more interesting because some of those train wrecks, by the sheer virtue of you have to have 26 songs in the final, will make the final. So it's always exciting to see. But I think certainly at the top, we have a number of fantastic entries competing this year. And it's going to be interesting to see who comes out on top.
Any favorites, William? Do you think is there a strong, maybe as you mentioned, maybe Norway?
Yeah, right now it seems to be a three-horse race between Denmark, the Ukraine, and Norway. Denmark has a teenager named Amalie DeForest, and apparently that is her real name, and she's singing a song called Only Teardrops, and it's about kind of the divisions we have between us, but it applies to love, politics, even the environment, and she essentially asks how many times can we make these same mistakes over and again? All we're left with is teardrops. It has a really tribal sound. There's a lot of drumming, and that's balanced with really soft wooden flutes, which will appeal to Celtic voters, but also to those in the Balkans. The second contender, at least according to the odds makers, is Ukraine. Her name is Lata Ognovic, and she's singing a very Lion King Disney-esque song called Gravity, and in her music video she rides unicorns, and she's doing flips and twists inside of butterfly cocoons, but it really showcases her vocals, because this woman can sing, and she's backed by Cleveland Watkiss, who is one of the world's most famous jazz singers. The song is It's very difficult to define, but it sounds like it would fit in a nature documentary you'd see on National Geographic. And the third favorite is Margaret Berger from Norway, who has this electronic song, I Feed You My Love. I'm not exactly sure what her song is about, but she has very dark lyrics, such as, you put a knife in my back and expect me to survive the attack. But rather than hating on this man, she feeds him her love, which I guess makes all the problems go away.
Unicorns and butterfly cocoons. How can you possibly not love Eurovision? That was William Lee Adams speaking to Fernando Augusto Pacheco. And of course, you'll be able to enjoy our Eurovision series all week here on Midori House. And I am happy to report that Fernando flies to Malmo on Thursday and will be bringing us all the highlights from Eurovision as the week progresses.
And as we have it, he joins us in the studio here in Midori House to tell us a bit more about his plans and also hopefully introduce us to his favorite ever Eurovision winning song. Welcome, Fernando.
Welcome, and I'm so excited this week, you have no idea.
I've never seen Fernando more excited in the past few weeks than he is now.
After seeing you come into the studio and listening to that item, I am pretty excited about it as well. Tell us, what are your plans then?
Well, I'm flying to Malmo Thursday morning. I'm going to watch the second semi-final Thursday evening and then getting ready for the big final. It's my first time at Eurovision, and I'm being a huge fan. I mean, since actually my favorite song won in 98, which I'm going to tell you in a minute.
Well, we were hearing a bit of William speaking to us about his picks of the contest, Denmark, Ukraine, Norway. You're not a big fan, though, of the Danish act, are you? You said...
I know. I'm not a big fan. It's like a ballad. It is a bit boring, in my opinion, but I agree with William. She is one of the favorites. But, you know, I prefer something a little bit more up-tempo. You know, that's why I like the Norwegian entry, Margaret Berger, which is, she's actually in our playlist, the M24 playlist. And I think she could win. She's quite similar to the Swedish one, Loreen with Euphoria, you know. So I think we might...
Can you see a collection of winning ingredients? Does it involve choreography, acrobatics, up-tempo music? I mean, you said you don't like the ballads particularly, but, I mean, can you pick a winner by the number of things they add to their spectacle?
I think they like to vary. You know, sometimes people do need a ballad. I'm never, like, a big fan of ballads. I prefer the up-tempo, the crazy Ukrainian singers and shaking everything, you know, but anyway, but... I think people like to change, you know. So, for example, Loreen last year, when she won, there was quite an electro track. And usually those kind of tracks don't win Eurovision. But as William said, that was the first time. So I think we're open for surprises sometimes.
And the British act, of course, this year is Bonnie Tyler. Never really puts much of a... The Brits never really put much of a good show, do they?
Well, they used to do in the 80s. Come on, they had Buckface, Making Your Mind Up, Brotherhood of a Man, Save Your Kisses from Me. But, not anymore.
Well,
I
have to admit, that's probably one of the reasons I'll be watching it. And last year's Engelbert Humperdinck had me hooked until he was knocked out. Fernando, tell us what your favorite winning song is.
Well, let's play this classic song. This was the winning song, 98, Dana International with Diva. She's an Israeli transgender, which caused a lot of controversy in Israel at the time, but the song is just great. And that's how I discovered Eurovision. So it's a very special song.
And I think that song sums up Fernando perfectly in every possible way. That was Diva by Dana International.
Now you're listening to Midori House with me, Poppy Trowbridge, and Phil Hahn. And it's time for a roundup of the day's Nordic papers. And for this job, we are joined in the studio by Monocle's producer and presenter, Marcus Hippe. Welcome, Marcus.
Hello, how are you doing?
The unsung star of the show, producing our show today. What have you got for us in the Nordic papers today?
Let's start from Finland. Finnish broadcasting company Yle starts television news in Russian today. There has already been news in Russian on the internet and on the Finnish radio, but this is yet another example of how Russian language is actually becoming ever more... common in Finland. There is more Russians living in Finland at the moment than ever before, over 50,000 at the moment. And the number of Russian tourists is about 10,000 every day in Finland. And basically what Finnish broadcasting companies after, they want to have Finnish point of view to the things for the Russian audience. It's part of integration as well.
It's quite interesting though, because do you find that Finns are more, you know, they're trying to tend to look away from Russia and try to be more independent and kind of move away from perhaps the way things were in the past?
Well, at the same time, realizing that Russia is such a big and dominant neighbor, I think that also increases the importance of having your own news in that language, kind of to balance the opinions and to give the point of view of Finland to the things. Another news story from Finland is actually this is from Melbourne. This is a research ranking list put together by Melbourne University. Finnish universities are world's sixth best.
What did they say are their top qualities?
Well, according to this list, they were comparing how international the universities are, how much of their articles get published abroad, and also about funding. It's amazing being number six, but actually quite many Finns are questioning why we are number six. Because anyway, Finnish education system is supposed to be number one.
And from the Finnish point of view,
naturally.
They're
not happy with number six?
No, we are not happy with number six. On this list, number one is the US, Sweden is number two, Switzerland is number three. On the other hand, behind Finland on this list, there are countries such as the UK, Germany and France. But the biggest problem with Finnish universities is that they are not particularly international.
So does it grate a bit that Sweden's number two, but comfort you a bit as well that the UK comes after Finland?
Yeah, you shouldn't feel that. But anyway, it's quite nice to be on the sixth spot anyway. But what Finland really needs to work, what Finnish university world really needs to work with, is trying to attract more international students. Universities are free. I'm always wondering about the same thing. Why don't people go there more often? But I think the problem is that people are afraid of having to learn Finnish.
You're looking at two aviation stories as well on the front pages. Tell us about SAS and Finnair.
There is an article on Svenska Dagbladet in Sweden. There's speculation about what Lufthansa is going to be up to in the Nordic countries. Lufthansa and SAS have been working in very close cooperation for the last 18 months or so. They've been planning the schedules together, and they've been also sharing the expenses of that traffic. And, well, this deal is over now, and it seems that Lufthansa wants to start something in Scandinavia. Scandinavia is quite a significant market for Lufthansa, actually. There were almost 2 million passengers last year travelling by Lufthansa between Sweden and Germany. We don't really know what Lufthansa is going to start, but something is definitely happening. Another aviation story from the north, Finnair just published their latest results, and, well, there are more positive news. Finnair has had quite a rocky ride during the last years, as so many other aviation companies have as well, but now it seems that the savings scheme is working, and before we even realise, Finnair is going to be profitable.
That's do we know where that growth is coming from? Is it on its more domestic services, long haul?
It's so much about Asia.
Cutting costs.
It's so much about Asia. Actually, it was also announced that Finnair wants to double the profits from the traffic between Asia and Europe by the year 2020.
And Marcus, very quickly, we have time for your pick of Eurovision 2013. Do the Finns have a chance?
I don't know. Finns always feel that we don't have a chance. And that's why we sometimes do very desperate things, as sending this hard rock metal death band Lorde to Eurovision that just happened to win once. Krista Siegfrieds is there performing for Finland, and I don't think Finns really believe that she's going to win that. But on the other hand, you never know, and you should never be that pessimistic.
Fingers crossed. Monocle's Marcus Hippie, thanks very much. That is all the time we have for today. Thank you to Marcus, our producer. Our researcher was Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Lily Hess. Our studio manager was Alex Funnel. Up next after the news is The Urbanist, hosted by Monocle's editor Andrew Tuck. But for me, Phil Hahn.
And me, Poppy Trowbridge.
Bye-bye.
A Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.